So I want to talk today about Jainism, sometimes pronounced Jainism or Jainism. I usually go towards Jainism. It's easier for me to say, but it may be, you may hear it pronounced different ways depending on region and dialect and things like that. So what I want to do is give us an overview of the religion and then talk about its connection to nonviolence. In particular, its connection to Gandhi. And Gandhi was heavily influenced by Jain philosophy. And Jain philosophy was the foundation of his theological or philosophical focus on nonviolence. And so I want to spend a little time just thinking about that, processing that. Hopefully some of you have already thought about that. Most people are familiar with Gandhi's work, but I find that a lot of people are not familiar with Jainism. And so it kind of provides us with a sense of rootedness. And for me, Jainism really provides this, what I talked about in Buddhism about the sort of neurotic intentionality about our lives. What it does is sort of have this very extreme nonviolent tendencies. And I'll talk about that. So Jainism is primarily in India. Most Jains are found in the region of India, although there are Jain communities throughout the world. Many of them exist in what's known as the Punjab region, which is the area between India and Pakistan. This is also where we find the birthplace of the Sikh movement. So if you're familiar with Sikhism, Sikhism is born in that same region as well. So if we were to do a map of where most Jains live, it would be that region and then sort of in the western part of India as well. So that's where they're. About 4.5 million Jains in the world. Not that many. It's a fairly small community. So this is from the Pew Research Center. The vast majority of Jains live in India, though significant numbers also are found among Indian immigrant communities in Kenya, the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. The 2010 Indian census said there were about 4.5 million Jains in India, but some Jains have contended that that number is a substantial undercount. Right? It's sort of like when somebody asks you how many people are in worship on Sunday morning. Right, pastors tend to exaggerate those numbers a bit sometimes. I don't know any of you are pastors if you do that, so, but I'm sure you do. So according to the estimates by the World Religion Database, there are about 250,000 Jains outside of India. So this is kind of giving you an idea of where Jains live. So what is Jainism? So it begins as a movement of protest, a movement of extreme ascetics, and a movement of respect for all living things. Very focused on that. Their founder, this is kind of the main things. Well, the word Jain means conqueror. In Hindu tradition, the name is given to the leaders of the movement. So often that term Jain, before Jainism was born, Jain was a term that meant conqueror, and someone who was the leader or the person who proved himself to be the strongest was a Jain or a conqueror. It originates in about the 6th century BCE, and it's part of a cultural protest against the authority of the priestly class. That's a typo. I had too many classes there. So priestly class. It's just the priestly class. This is a statue of their founder, Mahavira, who was a kind of dissident intellectual. If you read the writings of Mahavira, you'll find just this rich wealth of philosophy in what he talks about and says. And he was way beyond his time, way far above his time in many ways. He wrote about theology. He wrote about science. He wrote about cosmology. He was prolific in his writings, in his studies. Mahavira literally means the great hero. He, again, like I mentioned, he challenged the priestly class. He was given a certain title as the founder of Jainism. And Mahavira was the 24th successor of a lineage of leaders who exemplified the giving spirit, what we might call the service above self attitude. So it was said that he was part of a long lineage of folks that saw the world from a certain perspective or lens or angle. It was prophesied that he would be the bringer of peace, happiness, wisdom that was unprecedented in Hindu history. His birth and death are often debated, but somewhere around 600 to 525 BC, again, depending on the histories that you read, it might vary in that as well. Mahavira was the second son of a wealthy Indian ruler, a member of the warrior protector class, married with a daughter, left his family at age 30 to follow a band of ascetics. And hopefully this begins to sound familiar, right? Right? Who else does this, right? We tell the story of Buddha. Buddha is a member of the warrior protected class. He's married, has children, and decides to leave it all to go and find enlightenment. Mahavira, same thing, right? Jesus does similar things too, although we don't recognize Jesus as someone from a wealthy class, but has the same sort of thing, leaves his family, goes out to find enlightenment and the answers to life as well. Soon he was disillusioned with his community and decided to live a more ascetic lifestyle. He tore his hair and beard. He walked naked through the villages. And this might sound odd, it might sound strange, but they say he was not the only naked beggar out there in India at the time. In fact, it was a common practice often in Hindu communities that sannyasins or students of Hinduism would give up all of their worldly possessions, including their clothes, and depend solely on the kindness of strangers. So, you know, lest it sound a little bit odd, it wasn't completely out of the ordinary. But he stayed off the road to avoid insects. He began to understand this principle of nonviolence was a very, very important to him. Like I said, he's not the only naked beggar in town. He said to team up with a few others. And the myth says that he wandered for 12 years, giving up all his worldly possessions, even his clothes, severe asceticism and ahimsa, which I'll talk about later, finally claimed to have obtained moksha, and became a teacher. So if you remember our conversation about Hinduism, moksha is the release from the karmic cycle. So as we, it's a word that means liberation. So karma is this birth, struggle, death, birth, struggle, death, birth, struggle, death, and moksha is the liberation from that to achieve enlightenment. Most people don't realize moksha in their life. They don't find that enlightenment or that liberation in this lifetime, but it was said that Mahavira did. Alright, so he labeled himself a conqueror, for 30 years preached this kind of severe lifestyle. He became the incarnation of the divine. His followers would call him an omniscient god. So, just like many of our religious stories, he didn't set out to start a movement, right? He didn't start out to be the Son of God. He started out as a human being, seeking answers, seeking to live a life of peace, a life of harmony, a life of connection, and he gained this huge following, who soon elevated his status. We could argue that, the incarnation of the divine, that we could argue that this sort of incarnational theology or philosophy is found in Buddhism, in Christianity, in Islam to a certain extent. So not too different. We see some parallels there. Any questions up to this point? So this is basically just history. So keep going. All right. He publicly opposed the caste system. He opposed the many deities of Hinduism. Some say he was an atheist. He rejected the Hindu scriptures. So he wasn't real popular. The only path to liberation is oneself. Again, just like the Buddha, there's a little bit of an irony, right? That he said one can only find liberation if one is on their own path, but it was his followers who said he was the incarnation of the divine. He had some alterations of karma, and he began to formulate this dualistic notion of what we call jiva and ajiva, or ihiva and ahiva, depending on your pronunciation of that J. And jiva would be known as the soul and mind, and ajiva would be the matter, lifeless things. Again, hopefully we begin to see some parallels with Buddhism. The whole idea is to liberate oneself from that material possessions, those things that are without life, and only focus on those things of the soul. So gods and prayers and worship and rituals for Mahavira said they were just completely pointless. Karma is too tied up with the material world, so one must adopt asceticism to achieve karmic success, in a way. So, in the very beginning, Mahavira had five great vows. And as we go through the tradition, what we learn is that much of their philosophy and ideology focus on these things. So, extreme focus on renouncing killing and denying the right of others. Mahavira wrote volumes upon volumes about the danger of lying. So, renouncing all vices associated with lies, greed, fear, laughter, or anger, and to repudiate indifference to the lies of others. Mahavira really focused on that, which is very good and practical wisdom, I think, but really focused. To renounce all forms of stealing. For Mahavira, now not later, Jains kind of adopted and changed this, renouncing all sexual pleasure. I don't say this is Mahavira's quote, when there are evil and the greatest temptation of the world. So he wasn't a big fan. But like...
and he was married and had children.
Right, yeah. But, right.
Then he renounced?
Yeah.
Before he was enlightened.
Before he was enlightened, he left. Buddha did the same thing. You know, Buddha did the same thing. He left his family and his children to go and find enlightenment. Which brings up a very good paradox about, for Buddhism particularly, and to a certain extent Jainism, this question of egalitarianism. Could you really trust a leader who kind of has given up on all of that life, but still promotes peace and harmony for all of creation? Well, how does that work? So it's a contradiction and a paradox that we wrestle with in these traditions. Yes, sir?
Refresh my memory of when Buddha was around.
Yes, we'll get there. So I'll have a timeline pretty quickly.
I see.
So, yes, we'll get there, and I'm going to point that timeline will come up. Yes.
So did he differentiate sexual pleasure from procreation?
So initially, Mahavira said that in order to achieve karmic success, we ought to be completely celibate. Right? But like a lot of separatist organizations, at some point they realize, well, that's not going to work out for us. Right? If you study early American history, as the Puritans began to move around and move west, there were a lot of separatist movements, right? The Shakers started out as a separate movement. There was the Oneida community. They did make silverware later on, but they were a separatist community that renounced all forms of sex. Well, at some point they went, well, that's not going to work for us because our movement will never survive. But it is that mind-body dualism that we find within lots of traditions of the idea that the body is filthy and the mind, you know, is elevated as something greater than. I think we could probably find that in Christianity in certain circles as well. Sure. Yes, sir.
Is number two indictment, like the lies arising from laughter, is that again an indictment of sarcasm?
Yeah. Yeah.
As before? Okay.
Yeah.
I do not understand.
Say that again.
Oh, wait. Opposing sarcasm.
Yes, so opposing sort of laughter and greed and fear that all arise out of a sort of lie. So sarcasm, I shared an example in one of our previous sessions about how sarcasm is just this defense mechanism that we put up to really lie about how we truly feel about something. That's not to say I don't engage in sarcasm quite often. It's a very easy defense mechanism that I have done very well, and I'm working on it. But it is. It's a way we can make a joke out of something, or we can be sarcastic about something in order to hide our true feeling about it. You know, it's much easier to joke and to play instead of to say, I'm uncomfortable. Right. Yeah. Then again, number five, renouncing all forms of attachment to anything that might cause pleasure or pain. So I have to share the story. I was walking with a group of people just this week on Thursday, and somebody asked me, you know, well, what are you going to be talking about on Friday? And I said, talk about Jainism, which is known for its sort of extreme nonviolent stance on life. And this young boy, who's, you know, very smart kid, he says to me, like, well, what if somebody was suffering, or what if a creature was suffering? Would you then put that creature out of its misery? Well, from a Jain perspective, the answer is no. because suffering is a part of life, right? And the principle of do no harm means to not interfere or engage with the natural processes of life in that way. So that's it. All right, I already said that. So today, a little more than 4 million people. There are about 4 principal sects of Jainism, and you'll see, like a lot of major world religions, we go from kind of extreme adherence to this kind of fundamentalist conservative belief and this gradual progression towards a more reformed or liberal perspective on things. Not that reformed is necessarily the same thing as liberal. All right. So there's one sect where all they do is wear one white garment. They renounce all material possessions. They wear white garments, but they've allowed women into their movement. This is what we might call the white clads of Jainism. The sky clads that still practice total nudity. These are very small groups, but they still exist in parts of India. Women are excluded from parts of California. Yeah, I don't know, on the beaches. California. Women are excluded from temples and monasteries, and women must be reborn as men to enter the temple. Well, we won't get into it. It's a very complicated and involved process. But it goes back to Mahavira's teaching about the evilness of women.
What do they live off of for, like, income?
Yeah, so a lot of the Jains today are engaged in social service and helping organizations. So they're starting hospitals or hostels. There's quite a few hostels, if you travel through India, that are run by Jain communities that provide hospitality. So the hospitality industry and social service agencies as well. Yeah. All right. So this movement, which is a reform movement, not practicing, they really rejected the idea of venerating statues, which is a part of Hinduism. They had simple buildings. They focused on meditation and austerities. And this last one is the more developed of the Jain movements. So they have a structure and a guru strict in their practice. This particular group of Jains have been probably most focused on sharing those principles and ideas of nonviolence in the world. All right. They have some sacred scriptures, depending on the subgroup, but they have what they call cosmological philosophies and doctrines of karma and passions. These are the two sort of sacred texts. Like I mentioned before, Mahavira was way ahead of his time when regards to philosophy and cosmology and his knowledge of what the stars were doing and things like this as well. So in Jainism, morality of the individual is supreme. It's important to note that morality is not theology, but a philosophy of life. Most Jains will say that Jainism is an atheistic movement, so it's not focused on a supreme being. So Jainism is generally regarded as a movement absent of a supreme god, or there might be some room for a divine reality or a spiritual realm, but not so much as a god figure or godhead, if we can say that. Yeah.
I was not here for your Buddhism.
Yeah.
Pitch. Is this similar to Buddhism in that regard?
Yeah. Yeah. So this is something a very close parallel to Buddhism in its sort of rejection of the idea of a godhead or a divine reality. That it's much more about connection and harmony with the universe. Yeah.
So this isn't something that they would perchance treat as a philosophy while also subscribing to a recognized religion?
So, say that again. I wasn't sure I understood completely.
So, I'm just wondering, they wouldn't treat this, for example, as a philosophy while subscribing to a religion also?
Right. Oh, okay, I see what you're saying. So if this, could one maybe believe in a sort of Jain philosophy while still maintaining an adherence to a particular religion?
Correct.
Yes. I think probably you would find people who would buy into the philosophy. Like all Eastern religions, there's there's a lot of space for both and, okay. right? There's a lot of opportunities to be both a Buddhist and a Hindu, or to be someone who believes in the teachings and life of Confucius, but also follows the traditions of Jainism. So it's not as exclusive. I would say Eastern religion as a whole, in general, is not as exclusive in its belief system as Western religion might be. So there's much more focus on practice and not belief. So we use that term orthodoxy, right, which means right belief. And then we talk about Eastern religions, we often talk about orthopraxis, or right practice. Orthodoxy, orthopraxis. In general, those are generalizations, but in general, I'd say that. Yeah. Okay. All right. Time in the universe for Jainism is eternal and formless. The universe is infinite, beginningless, and endless. There are no gods, no creator, no ultimate being. Time and space change constantly, right? So we can't really grab onto anything. It's basically what this is saying. It's a principle of non-attachment, but it's also very careful that we don't lock ourselves in any sort of doctrinal or orthodoxy in the belief system. All right, as I mentioned before, Jiva and Aviva is a life characterized by consciousness and mental clarity. Possibilities are endless. Eternal bliss is possible. So what we might call the different forms of Jiva rely on these five senses. And what's interesting, these are all pretty simple. We all learn these in grade school, right? But one of the things that's different about Jain philosophy is this belief that we can communicate and connect with animals and deities and demons, right? And people are beginning to go, well, wait a minute, I thought God didn't exist, right? But it's very complicated, this idea that there are spiritual beings in the world, deities or demons that we might connect with. Jain philosophy really focuses on that sort of idea of communicating with the natural world. So much so that Mahavira was somebody who was said to be able to communicate with insects and able to connect with the bees and able to connect and communicate with the ants to learn more about how the universe and the world works. So it's very grounded in the natural and created world is what you need to take away from that, probably. So you talked a little bit about karma. So again, this is a sort of evolution or an adaptation of karma. He says that matter gets stuck to one's karma, and true liberation and karmic evolution only comes with living life without stickiness. Which I really like that idea. I think that's a really great way to think about it, that all of the things that we take on as material possessions just sort of stick to us. And we walk around this, and we talk about having a weight on us. So the more we accumulate, the more things we have, the more weighted down we are. And as we're able to let go of those things, material possessions and longing and lusting for material possessions, the lighter and the more connected we'll be with one another, with the world, with those things as well. So we talked about transcendence. Right? Transcendence is a word that just means, in contrast to immanence, which is something within us, transcendence is something above and beyond us. So to transcend, it's a recognition that there is a higher power or a higher force out there in the world. Again, the frustrating thing about Eastern religion for most Westerners is that it's so paradoxical, right? There's so many contradictions because you go, well, wait a minute, I thought you said this. Well, yeah, and the answer is always yes. And that's what we learn in Eastern religion is that, well, is it this or is it that? Is it transcendent or is it immanent? Is it divine reality or is it atheistic? Well, the answer in all of those is yes. And that's a very difficult thing for us in interfaith dialogue because we tend to operate in Western religions in what I call kind of these binaries, right? It exists either here or it's here, right? It's black or white. it's male or female, it's gay or straight, right? But Eastern religion leaves us a lot of room for the spectrum, you know, that it's actually somewhere along the lines of here. Gender and identity and orientation and all things, that is actually more on a spectrum than it is this or that. And that's very common in Eastern practice and Eastern religion. Any questions about any of this? Okay. All right. So eventually we get to this, what I call the modified rules for engagement for contemporary genes. 19, ahimsa always, which I'm getting there. Never lie, never steal, never cheat. Check one's own greed by giving away excess and avoid temptation. These are all pretty practical advices, right? These are all things we can buy into.
Well, and they maintain a lot of similarity with the Ten Commandments.
Sure. Yep. Yep. Very much so. Again, other considerations: to live simply and limit materialism, as I said. Lead a simple life. Meditate at specified time periods. Kind of up to you, but it's just to say to create a rhythm. Mahavira and Jains would say there's no hard and fast rules about what time or what days, but to develop a rhythm in your own life, a consistent pattern of that meditation. And to observe periods of self-denial and fasting, spending time occasionally in a monastic lifestyle, give alms generously, especially to monks and ascetics, right? If we understand the history of Mahavira, we see this makes perfect sense, right? This is where he started, this is where he's moving to. So, as we talked about just a little bit earlier, so what are Jains known for? They founded a lot of welfare institutions, primarily in India. They're known for public lodging. They often help the poor and the helpless, and many contributions to philosophy. So if you travel throughout India, most of the public lodging institutions that you'll find, particularly in Western India, are operated and run by Jains. So they strongly believe in helping the other and the stranger. Yeah.
Does that include helping women who are poor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it does. So I would say, and in general, the population of Jains that are kind of what we might label as misogynistic is very small. For the most part, like most of the world, they've evolved kind of beyond that. But like all of us, all of our religions have still got work to do, right? We're still haven't quite arrived there yet to a place. And I think we could talk about Christianity and Judaism, Islam, any major world religion. We're still working through that, right? We're still working through the patriarchy. And we're still trying to get to that. Yeah. All right, so how do they overlap with Hinduism and Buddhism? They retain the rites of birth and marriage and death. Some of them adopted worship and veneration of gods and goddesses, maintain connections to the church Ankaras, which is a Buddhist sacred text, those who spent their life helping and bettering society. So there's some overlap there. And again, back to your question, I think that there are plenty of Jains that would say that they identify and connect with Buddhism, and there's this overlap and connection between the two. They have a reputation for honesty and morality. They're successful in business. This is one quote said, as a group that began with asceticism and poverty has become, by virtue of its respect for life, one of the wealthiest classes of India. And this is by a scholar. Just an interesting perspective. All right, so somebody asked about the comparative timeline. Where are we at? Okay, so let's go back in history here a little bit. This is roughly the foundations and of major world religions. So we see Hinduism. Hinduism begins as an oral culture, just like Judaism does. Stories told around campfires. We have evidence of the Harappa culture in India that existed as far back as 8,000 BC. Jainism shows up on the scene about 599 to 527. Buddhism's a little bit after. And we can say Taoism and Confucianism later. And of course, Christianity and Islam are later on in history as well. So this
where does Sikhism fit in with that?
Where does Sikhism fit in with that? Good question.
It's quite a bit later.
Yeah, I believe Sikhism is quite a bit later. I believe Sikhism probably falls around the same timeline as Islam. I'm not 100% on that, but I think it's later. If anybody knows, they can correct me, but I'm not sure for doesn't matter. So, and so, what we talk about in world religions is we refer to this time period right around 600 BC to about 400 BC as the Axis Age.
Right.
Right? A lot of things are happening in this time period, right? We have the life of Mahavira. We have the life of Gautama, which is the Buddha. Lao Tzu, Confucius. This is also when the first temple is destroyed, the Jewish exile. It's also when we begin to see all of these sacred writings come together.
And not to mention Aristotle and Socrates.
Right, yes, and if we wanted to throw Aristotle and Socrates in there, we would see they're right around here. A lot of intellectual movements are happening in this time period. There's also a lot of stuff happening from agricultural and an industry age, so a lot of trading happening. There's an opening up of trade routes. That Mediterranean Sea area is just growing like crazy. There's a lot of cross-cultural interpretation. So for me, the Axis Age, as we look at this timeline, and then we begin to parallel these sacred texts, we begin to see why there is so much overlap. Why do we find connections between the stories of Confucius and the stories of Jeremiah, right? Because at this time, culture was expanding when people were beginning to trade with one another and move around the area, and these stories were shared among these different people and these different nations. And so it's this beautiful time in world religion where we begins to make sense. Okay, yeah, we begin to see how these things stack up and how they connect and how they relate to each other, which is kind of cool, I think. Any questions, comments about that?
So wasn't Zoroastrianism something that preceded these things, and wasn't that a monotheistic?
So Zoroastrianism, yeah, it's a religion that is founded in Iran,
yes.
Right? So it is monotheistic to a certain degree, and we probably find it showing up around the same time as Hinduism and Judaism and ancient, what we call ancient culture. It's in academic world, Zoroastrianism would be considered a Western religion, like Islam is considered a Western religion. And again, there's lots of reasons for that, but yeah, it's sort of included in that category. But it's an interesting syncretism or an interesting blend of a lot of different of these ideas. So if you study Zoroastrianism, what you'll find is this strange blend of monotheism. It's kind of a blend of Hinduism and Judaism almost. But regionally and geographically, it makes sense, right? You begin to look at where is Iran, where is Israel, where is ancient Babylonia. It's all right there, right? As people begin to move and migrate and change, these are all influenced by one another. Some of the earliest Zoroastrian texts talk about how some of the early Hebrew people were most likely worshiping the gods of the Zoroastrians or the Babylonians, or we hear a lot about that. And not to go down this rabbit hole too much, but there are some theories out there that believe that Judaism began as a polytheistic religion and eventually evolved its way into a monotheistic religion. And that's another lecture. But it's kind of an interesting theory to think about. That early Judaism was more polytheistic, and that monotheism became a way to separate themselves and a way to set themselves apart from the other religions in that community and area. So it became this practical thing. Not this great revelation, but again, how can we set ourselves apart from all of those other folks? Well, we can go to the one God, which was pretty radical. Like, we don't think about it as radical, but having one God, anyway. All right, so, watch. Anybody got a watch? Oh, right here, right behind you. Good, we're good. All right, so, what I want you to take away, if you take away anything, is to understand that Jainism contributes much to the theories and ideas of nonviolence. And for Gandhi, and likewise for Martin Luther King, and an extension of Gandhi. Ahimsa is a nonviolence at its most extreme form. If you've ever been in a Jain community, or you've been, there are pockets of Jain communities around the U.S., you'll often see people, of course, dressed in plain clothing, but carrying around a small broom to sweep the path in front of them. And this is both, this is a sort of ritualistic and a metaphoric, and in some way literal, but more so as a way of clearing the path as to not harm even the smallest of insects. Jains have been known to buy animals to set them free, which is kind of cool. fishing is forbidden, as well as slaughtering or selling animal flesh. Farming is often avoided because of the stress it puts on small animals and insects in the fields.
Yeah, it kind of limits your diet.
It really does limit your diet. Yeah, your nuts and seeds and vegetables, if you're very careful about the vegetables and fruit and not
harming
insects.
An egg? I mean, an egg.
Is Sarah, an probably apple. Not. Most Jains are pretty strict vegetarians and or vegans. If the animal is not harmed in any way, so if there's a free, you know, they're free range, right? If you have chickens walking around and they're laying eggs and then abandoning those eggs, then you're not causing harm to that animal, right? But if you're keeping chickens in a closed, confined space for the purpose of harvesting their eggs, then you're causing harm to that animal. I mean, I don't know. I raise chickens. I don't think chickens' brains are that big, but am I causing harm to them? But from a Jain perspective, one would ask, am I causing harm to this animal? Am I in a way limiting this creature that is part of the created world? So, you know, most Jains would say, you know, pets and animals are fine, but you have to give them the freedom and the space to be where they want, right? Don't limit them. So don't keep a dog on a leash. Don't keep chickens in a pen. You know, don't keep cows, but allow them to range free. So,
can you like shear sheep?
Maybe. Again, but if it is in no way harming that animal or causing harm of that. So
trauma. Maybe.
Trauma. Yeah, sure. Is it traumatic to milk a cow? I'm not a cow, I don't really know. My experience with milking cows, it doesn't seem like a pleasant experience for a cow. It just doesn't. But does the cow, is the cow able to say yes, you know? Yeah.
As we learn more about it, is there any involvement of like microorganisms?
Or? Yes. Okay. So actually there's a quite developed Jain philosophy around microorganisms. Very much so. Actually, Jains have been at the forefront of actually scientific study around microorganisms. And how they, so yes, that is. And there's been a lot written by Jain philosophers and Jain scientists about that very thing. Yeah. And actually, it's Mahavira who, one of the things that he was ridiculed for when he talked was he talked about living creatures, I don't know what the term he used, but essentially he was talking about living creatures that live on our skin and our bodies. And people thought he was nuts, right? People thought he was absolutely out of his gourd, right? But now we know through science that that is actually true. We've got all kinds of microorganisms living on our body. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so lice, like, in your care, like, that's annoying to a human.
It's annoying.
So who do you take care of, the lice or the humans?
I think from a very strict Jain philosophy and theology, one would say there are certain exceptions made to save the life of an individual. In a case like lice, lice doesn't harm you. It's annoying. It itches your head. But, you know, shakes your head off. Eventually they'll go away. Lice don't live on your head forever. I mean, I'm a parent. I've dealt with lice. Just thinking about it makes my head. So for monks and nuns, what this ahimsa meant was complete celibacy. And for non-monastics, this meant fidelity to one spouse. This was very important. One of the interesting conversations that show up in Jain philosophy is exactly what somebody said earlier about consent, right? And this is something, that was loud. This is something that they talked about very early on, is that engaging in sexual activity in a way that doesn't harm the partner. And actually, really fascinating, because it's if we think way ahead of its time, to think about that even through the act of sexual intercourse, one individual can be harmed, right? Both intentionally and non-intentionally, unless there's a lot of communication and a lot of conversation. We nowadays call that consent, right? But a lot of it's also of a level of awareness and conversation. I find that actually very fascinating from a sort of sociological and anthropological perspective, way above our times. And for centuries, Christians argued that sex was designed for procreation and procreation only, right? And for Jains, that was not the case. They talked a lot about this idea of how it promotes pleasure and how it promotes connection, and actually that sexual intercourse can be this really incredible connecting thing, but it can also be this incredibly harming thing as well. And so that's why fidelity is so important within their tradition too. All right. And again, when we talk a little bit about non-attachment, this is part of that is the idea of non-attachment, which is a very good parallel and overlap with Buddhism as well.
How long do these people live?
How long?
Yeah.
Like average lifespan, is that what you're asking? How long do Jains typically live?
Seems like it'd be short.
Interesting. I don't know. I don't think they're, what I know, that their lifespan is not any shorter, any longer. I'm not really sure the answer, but I don't know that I've read anything that would indicate a shorter or longer lifespan. I do know of certain studies of communities that are strict vegetarians, and Seventh-day Adventists being one of those communities. They have a longer average lifespan than almost anyone else. I don't know about these folks. That'd be an interesting story. So this is the quote I want to leave us with, because this is the name of my talk, but it was also one that I think speaks for itself and is really powerful if we can embrace it and understand it. And I'm going to read it for you. The universe is not for humanity alone, but is a theater of evolution for all living beings. Live and let live is its guiding principle. Non-injury is the highest religion. And this was by a gentleman, Gandhi, not Mahatma Gandhi, a different Gandhi, who spoke this. And this particular scholar, he was the Jain scholar who spoke at the World's Parliament of Religions in 1893. He heavily influenced the Gandhi most of us are familiar with in his legal practice, dietary practice, and insistence on nonviolent resistance. I think that's a good quote. Let's go ahead and stop there. Any questions, comments, or observations? Yeah.
I'm thinking of the stories or legends, or maybe the two, about St. Francis, mm-hmm. his nakedness, and kind of just his philosophy, and Claire, and is any connection between that?
I don't know.
Catholicism?
Yeah. I'm not sure that St. Francis had any exposure to Jainism, but certainly there are some parallels. I mean, St. Francis was someone who a lot of people at the time thought was a little bit off, but retrospectively, we think about St. Francis as someone who lived incredible communion with nature and with all living beings and with animals, right? His patron saint of animals, and he is said to spend hours talking to the birds, you know, or talking to animals, and so this deep connection. And for, as he wrote about it, St. Francis would say, they talked back, right?
Yes.
They communicated back with him. Other questions or comments?
When did Mahatma Gandhi start studying, or because he was also Hindu?
Right.
And he studied the Gita, and so.
So Mahatma Gandhi, I'm trying to think of the timeline. Trying to think of his birth. So he died in 1947, and I think that I want to say 1880s was born. So he was a very young man when he studied this teacher and began to study this teacher. But he was a lawyer first, right?
Right.
And then after he was a lawyer, he became, he worked for the British government for a little while and eventually began to protest some of the things that the British government was doing and to work for independence of. And so he was left his legal practice and began to a small community. His community that he began was heavily influenced by this Jain philosophy mm-hmm. and ideas. Yeah, and nonviolence particularly. Yeah.
What do they have houses of worship? Or do they have a approach to worship or anything like that? And the reason I ask is we stayed at a Gandhian ashram for a month in Bali, and they had prayers four times a day. And the interesting thing about the prayers was they had Hindu prayers, Christian prayers, they even had the Shema, they had Buddhist meditation, and because it was Bali, they had animus. All in, I didn't know whether that was because that was related to it being Jain kind of center, because they never talked about Jainism there.
Yeah.
They talked about it as being a Gandhian ashram.
There's a pretty strict rejection of what we might call houses of worship. Or it might be called buildings that are set aside for one particular group. If anything, Jainism is very interfaith in its approach to things, and so they have a lot of like public lodging, or they have different centers, or what we might call an ashram. And so, but there aren't specified rules of worship or prayers that are necessarily unique to Jainism. So it depends on which sect of Jainism is a part of it. But for the most part, they're really focused on connecting and communicating on a broader basis with the greater society, you know, in that way. So they wouldn't start a, build a Jain center necessarily.
Is there any conflict between majority Hindus and Jains in India, or are they just like, they're not even worth bothering about?
Well, in some ways, the connection between Jains and the Indian government is, they're a small group. You know, we're talking about 4.5 million people, a slice of the pie in Indian population. And up until probably the most recent election of the new Indian prime minister, they've lived a life of peace. The new Indian prime minister is pretty nationalistic in his approach to things, and they've been met with some pressure to adhere to what might be called a more nationalistic identity and strict. So one of the things that the Indian prime minister is doing is trying to create more conformity of rights, so marriage rights, burial rights, birth rights, and trying to get the entire country to kind of adhere to some of those similars. And so Jains are not too happy about that, but you're also not going to find a Jain protest either, probably. You may find some nonviolent resistance, but for the most part, I think they try and intentionally do live a life of pretty simplicity and away from any sort of spotlight. And that's why they're not very well known.
Right.
Anything else? Yeah.
Sorry,
that's okay.
In and out. Do they take a vocal stance on abortion?
Not that I'm aware of. My guess is if you were to ask that question, they would get into a lot of the philosophy around when does life begin and things like that, and it's much in the same way that we probably have that argument. I don't know of, I'm not aware of that, so I don't know what they do. Again, they're not real public about a lot of things, and so they don't have many official positions, just like a lot of Eastern religions. They don't have a lot of official positions on X, Y, or Z, or doctrinal statements on X, Y, or Z. Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Go for it.
I was going to say, I'm clunking a bit on the phrase theater of evolution, which I know you picked intentionally as the title of the talk, but it was one of the things that intrigued me because it doesn't necessarily seem like you could intuit directly between evolution and a nonviolent lifestyle.
Yeah, I guess if you're going to argue scientifically, evolution is kind of a violent process, right? in some ways. Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. But spiritually, I think is probably, yeah, I think I would lean more towards what this is speaking to is maybe not the scientific realities of evolution, but more of a kind of spirituality or evolution of humanity in a way as well. Maybe. Or not. Yes.
So why, how did you get interested in studying this?
Yeah, so a little bit of my story. I was, when I went to undergraduate school, I started out as a science major, took astronomy, and very quickly learned that I couldn't do physics. Then I was a journalism major, very quickly decided I didn't like that. And so I decided I'd be a world religions major. And so I was really could do that, and I was enthralled with that. It wasn't going to take me anywhere. At some point, I felt like I was called to ministry, and so I ended up going to seminary and studied at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, which is a consortium of theological schools and institutes. And it was there that I found Eastern practice and Eastern religions, took a lot of classes from the Institute of Buddhist Studies, really found that Eastern religion provided me with a sense of balance in my life. And it kind of it was a rejection of that dualism that Christianity, that I struggled with so much in Christianity, you know, that binary, you know, good, bad, evil, right, wrong stuff that I just had a hard time with. And so Eastern practice and religion provided that. And then fast forward, 10 years from now, I'm married, I have kids. And what I found myself, that I got really out of balance. You know, and I got really connected in with my ministry and my work, but I was kind of empty and broken inside at the same time. As I was trying to serve the world and serve the people, I was just, you know, my insides were just torn up, right? And I was really broken. And about the time that I was kind of at a hard point, a good friend of mine said, I really think you should come teach at the community college. And I went, I don't know. And I said, well, what do you want to teach? She said, Eastern religions. And I went, I'm not really qualified, although I took, 20 classes on Eastern religions in seminary. I don't really have, that's not my degree. And she said, well, come talk to the dean and we'll talk about it. And the dean was like, oh yeah, you're perfect. I think you'd be good for this. And I was like, oh no, I don't want to do it. So I did, and what it did was it brought me back into the study. So teachers learn more than students most of the time. So it brought me back into the study of the religion, and it also brought me back to practice, meditation and yoga and mindfulness. And it really allowed me to kind of create that balance. So for me, in my personal journey, staying connected with Eastern story and Eastern practice is something that keeps me whole in a way that I just I can't get it all. I can't get it all here, so I've got to find this balance, this unique way. And for Eastern religion folks, and adherence to those religions, that's not an issue. It can be an issue in Christianity. Right? Because we sometimes demand exclusivity, and that's challenging. And my congregation deals with me mostly. So. And sometimes I'll go off on talking about Confucius or Lao Tzu, and I get some eye rolls, in the congregation. But for the most part, I think most people appreciate it, And to see the complementarianism, and to see the connections between Christianity and Confucius and Jesus and Buddha, is, I think most people really, really appreciate it. And it's all right there. It just makes sense. It's all connected, right? We have all these great spiritual leaders, and they're all right on the same level, the same plane. They're all sharing the same stuff, right? It's all about love and connection, connecting with our deepest selves and connecting with God and connecting with each other, and about love and all that material BS, Yeah, right? All the major prophets talk about how horrible materialism is, right? All about giving your life away. Those who want to be first have to be last. All that business, right? They all said that. We're still trying to figure that out, though. Yeah.
How did Jainists view carnivorous animals that have to harm their prey to survive?
Well, again, it's because it's more personal. That would be, that's the natural created world. And as long as Jains aren't interfering on that, live and let live, then there's not a conflict. As long as, I'm not trying to interfere with the natural order of things, then we're okay, right? It's living in harmony with all living things. It's like those incredibly crazy deer around this place. I've never been to the whole village before, right? This is my first year. And it's so odd. Like, for me, and everybody's like, oh, look, it's the deer. And I'm like, it's right there. It's right there. It's so strange. Like, it almost seems unnatural in a way. The chipmunks don't bother me as much. But the deer, whoa. But then we talk about living in harmony with that, but then we start talking about the bears, and it's just like, ooh, that's a different thing. And I heard somebody say, oh, we ran by a bear, it's so beautiful. And I was like, yeah, it is, but we have to really respect nature and respect the order of things as well. So it's part of figuring out how that's done. And, you know, those chipmunks, if whole village wasn't here, they probably wouldn't survive, you know, they're surviving off of, but so there's this symbiotic relationship between the chipmunks and Holden Village, but yeah, I don't know. Anyways.
Yeah, so that brings up another question. So I had this one experience when I was in the bush in Africa, and we had to go with a guide who had a rifle, because he said, you know, when you're out here, you're food.
Right.
And at one point, we were being tracked by some wild dogs. Mm. And he made us get real close together and all that. And I really, first time in my life I ever experienced myself as just food.
Yeah.
Would James use a gun to protect themselves if something was going to
attack them? Absolutely not. Yeah,
so no. How would they protect them? I mean, there must be wild animals. They...
Well, it probably wouldn't go, maybe. But even if there is a marginalized awareness of the risk involved, right? If I'm going to wander out into the thicket or the bushes, I recognize that I might get eaten, right? And so it's, again, back to that sort of neurotic intentionality and being aware of that. And I, you know, as we were hiking off to Heart Lake, right, and even, I don't think about bears until I see the bear. And then I'm very aware of the bear. But it is about really thinking through all of those things. And so I think the idea of harming another individual or harming an animal, to think about the ramifications of that in one's soul. And so we can justify it, and we could get into this too, but we could justify that violent response to an animal, and the next step is justifying a violent response towards a human being. You know, and the example I give often when thinking about nonviolence is the opportunity that violence gives us to embrace humility. So when 9/11 happened, right, as those planes flew into the Twin Towers, we had this opportunity as a nation, I'm getting political here, but I'm okay with that, but we had, as a nation, had the opportunity to say, why do people hate us so much? They're willing to get in a plane and kill themselves to destroy our symbols of wealth. But we never asked that question. We simply just said, find them, smoke them out of their holes, and kill them, right? That's what we said immediately. We didn't have a time to even think about why somebody would do that. And those were the exact words. I remember seeing that rhetoric played over and over again. Smoke them out of their holes, smoke them out of their holes. And it just began to feed that. And we began to feel like, yes, we need to take revenge on whoever wronged us instead of taking a step back of humility and going, why would somebody hate us that much? We had an opportunity to change our pride, but we didn't. But we didn't. We missed it. We missed that. Anyways. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you.